I'm Alex Amon, your non-binary host, and this is the 58th episode of The Art of Asymmetrical Warfare. Today I'll talk about women during the Irish Civil War. Just a content warning, this episode will be discussing sexual assault, rape, and sexual violence. Before we get into the meat of the episode, it's the betting for money time. Given that the holidays are coming and that I am facing the potential job change, it would be really great if you could support this podcast by joining my Patreon, www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare. All donations help me to run this podcast, to get the information I need for this podcast, ensure that I have a place to record this podcast. Sure, I have food so I can work on the podcast. Any bit of donation really helps. And if you join my Patreon, you get really cool, like, sneak peeks and extras and stuff like that. And now, it's time for Making History. Last week, or the week before, I did a special episode about how to end the genocide in Palestine. So if you want a more in-depth look at how you can help, please listen to that episode. Keep finding protests to participate in. Keep finding ways to delay weapons and supplies getting to Israel. Keep talking about what's going on in Palestine. Keep calling your reps and your senators and even your governors. Keep pressuring Biden and keep finding ways to spread the word about what's happening, right? Write op-eds, write blog posts, go on TikTok, however you can. We gotta keep talking about Palestine. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, has taken the Al-Shifa Hospital, and they've already started to claim that they found bodies of hostages there, they found Hamas fighters there. What they don't want you to know is that Gaza is now completely cut off of all water, and so diseases like cholera are rising, and that all of the patients in the ICU in the Al-Shifa Hospital are dead. They died because the Israelis cut off the electricity and cut off the water. So I think that was like 30 to 40 people. Just, they're dead. So they went to a hospital because it was an emergency. We are now at 11 to 12,000 killed, 4 to 5,000 children killed, and Israel's also attacking the West Bank, which doesn't have any Hamas fighters. So things are going to continue to be ugly as we go into the end of November and into December. So please keep calling, keep protesting, keep learning and educating yourselves, keep uplifting Palestinian voices, and just don't go silent. We can't go silent on this. And while Palestine has rightfully taken center stage for a lot of people, there's another tragedy going on, this time in Afghanistan. So in October, Afghanistan was hit by 4 massive earthquakes, killing over 3,000 people and injuring over 10,000 people. Pakistan has decided to forcefully deport 1.7 million Afghans back to Afghanistan. These families have no aid, no support. They've lived in Pakistan for years and decades. Sometimes you have like 3 generations of families who've lived in Pakistan. They're being sent back to Afghanistan, which is under Taliban control right now. They don't want to go back. They have no support system in Afghanistan. Lord knows what the Taliban will do to them once they arrive in Afghanistan, but Pakistan doesn't care. These people are just supposed to pack their things and leave. There are a number of organizations we can donate to help the people of Afghanistan. So the Kalam Project has a fundraiser for the Afghan Emergency Earthquake Appeal, and then they also have a fundraiser called the Afghan Returnee Resettlement Fund. Batula has an Afghan Emergency Kit Fund, Islamic Relief's Afghanistan Earthquake Emergency Fund, Human Concern International Support Earthquake Victims in Afghanistan Fund, and then Kalam Projects also has this new initiative called Sponsor Family in Afghanistan. It's basically where you make a donation. It can be a one-time donation, it can be a monthly donation, and it goes to a specific family. And now it's time to talk about women during the Irish Civil War. The study of women in Ireland, whether it be from a social or historical perspective, has been experiencing a renaissance, and it probably started in the 80s, and now we have this plethora of really fascinating work about women, not just the women of Tamanabon or other organizations, but just like, you know, women's everyday life in Ireland. There are amazing historians such as Linda Connolly, Mary McAuliffe, Gemma Clark, Margaret Ward, etc., examining not just the role of famous women like Constance Markievicz or Mary McSweeney or Kathleen Clark and Hannah Shea Steffington, who are all badasses, but also the role and experiences of everyday women who weren't even necessarily involved in republicanism or the free state apparatus, but still suffered from reprisals, acts of violence, etc., both during the Irish War of Independence and the Irish Civil War. Today I'll be focusing on how everyday women were affected during the Irish Civil War specifically. I'll talk about Tamanabon and the other women who actively participated in the Civil War in another episode. Part 1. Women in Irish Society in 1922. When we think of Irish society, I think one stereotype is that it is a very repressed, very capital C Catholic, very anti-women. Some of that reputation is earned because both the Cosgrave and De Valera administrations were very misogynistic and passed several laws and a constitution that restricted women's rights. However, the Irish society of the early 1900s, and I would argue beyond, but for the point of this episode, the 1900s, was far more dynamic and feminist than one would have expected. It began in 1876 when Anna Haslam created the Irish Woman Suffrage and Local Government Association, the IWSLGA, which campaigned for a greater role for women in local government and public affairs. The IWSLGA was followed by several other feminist organizations, including the Irish Women's Franchise League, IWFL, founded by the amazing Hannah Shea Steffington. These women fought long and hard for women's rights. They campaigned, they trusted their representatives in Parliament to pass a bill that would grant women 30 years and older with property the right to vote. However, the Irish Parliamentary Party kept finding reasons to vote against it, convincing some feminists, like Hannah Shea Steffington and Helena Mullaney, to use militant means. They threw bricks at Dublin Castle to protest the force feeding of British suffragettes in England. They organized mass protests of the visit of the King, the Prime Minister, Arthur Balfour, and Northern Ireland leaders such as James Craig. Hannah Shea Steffington was arrested for throwing a brick through a Dublin Castle window and briefly went on hunger strike until she was released. Don't mess with Hannah Shea Steffington. Ireland, especially Dublin, was a hotbed for many large and conflicting movements, and that includes the feminist movement. Some women, like Hannah, wanted to be far more militant, while others preferred a non-violent constitutional approach. Then there was the added complication of conflicting priorities and loyalties. Some women could balance fighting for both a nationalist cause and a feminist cause, or fighting for labor rights and feminist rights. Others felt it had to be an either-or choice. Women like Hannah felt that feminism was the most important cause of all, and had to be prioritized before all else. Others, like Constance Markievicz, believed that nationalism was the most important thing to fight for, and women's rights could be discussed after independence was won. There were even arguments that women like Hannah, who were fighting for women's rights within the British Empire, were actually traitors to the nationalist cause, because from the nationalist perspective, England didn't have the right to rule Ireland in the first place, so why are you asking for rights from the oppressor when we really should focus on overthrowing the oppressor and then talking about rights? Well, Hannah and the other feminists would counter-argue, okay, yeah, when are you planning to overthrow the oppressor? Because we still need to have the ability to control our future, even if it's in a limited manner. And yeah, England doesn't have any control over Ireland, or it shouldn't, but right now we're kind of trapped in this political system, and so we're going to try and make the best of it, basically. Also, there was no guarantee that even after independence was won, that people would be more inclined to support a feminist cause. And I think there's also thinking, like, if we can get it through England now, then there's a precedence. And when we do get our own government, we can be like, well, England gave us these rights, why won't you? Then there was the question of worker rights and women's rights, and would labor unions fight as hard for women workers as they would for the men? As World War I started and all hopes for home rule were dashed, women were faced with several different organizations and causes to fight for. Labor is probably the most progressive group at this time. organizations like the Irish Transportation and General Workers Union and the Irish Citizen Army were open to women and men, and women held equal roles. They learned how to lead, how to fight, how to treat wounds, and women like Constance Markievicz served as actual officers in the Irish Citizen Army. Another Irish Citizen Army member, Margaret Stinnader, served both as a nurse, messenger, and sniper during Easter Rising. However, these organizations were primarily labor organizations, and so feminism was understood within the context of worker rights. Hannah's organization, the IFWL, lost members because they protested World War I and still advocated militant techniques against an empire at war, alienating unionist women, women who had loved ones serving in the army, and nationalist women for prioritizing feminism over nationalist demands. Then Easter Rising happened, a defining moment for the women of Ireland because the proclamation Pierce Red included a phrase which promised equal rights and status to all genders, most likely included because of the campaigning of women like Hannah Shea Steffington, Constance Markievicz, Helena Mullaney, Kathleen Lynn, etc., and supported by influential men like James Connolly. Irish women had the choice of participating in the rising, being a victim of the rising, complaining to officials about the rising, or struggling to get along their day while the city was bombed and rebelling. Once the rebellion was defeated, the leaders were executed and several people were arrested, many who weren't even involved in the rising, and sent to jails all over Ireland, Wales, and England. It was up to the women of the victims to speak up and turn the population's opinion from one of contempt or indifference to support. Women like Kathleen Clark, wife to Tom Clark, organized the people's support via her charity that gathered funds for affected families. Hannah Shea Steffington's pacifist, feminist, non-conventional husband Frank was murdered while trying to prevent people from looting. His murderer was a British officer who was immediately transferred to protect the Empire's reputation. However, thanks to Hannah's efforts and the conscience of British officer Francis Vane, the officer was put on trial and acquitted on the case of mental illness. He was then relocated to Canada and was never formally charged for his crime. These kinds of stories, spread primarily by women and members of the Catholic Church, prepared Ireland for the return of the participants of Easter Rising and the Irish War of Independence. While many women took part in the Irish War of Independence via organizations like Cumann na Bán and Sinn Féin, other women took part simply by offering their houses as hiding places for rebels on the run, storing supplies for the IRA, serving as spies for Collins and other IRA officers, and carrying messages. Other women were involved simply because their cities were the center of violence, their homes were raided, their livestock and homes were destroyed, they were harassed physically and sexually assaulted and put under tremendous pressure by the presence of both the IRA and the British forces. These trends would continue into the Irish Civil War. By the time the treaty was signed, many women had either come to their own, felt entitled to have a say in the future government of their country, and felt they were in a position to ensure that feminist principles were upheld, or they were exhausted victims of a war who wanted peace, stability, and bread-and-butter issues addressed by the future government. Then there were the women who just wanted to survive, one way or another. No matter where they fell in the spectrum, the Irish Civil War would not only affect their homes, livelihood, and families, but would have a massive impact on the rights they would have after the war. Part 2. When Violence Enters the Domestic Sphere. In the book Women and the Irish Revolution, Mary McAuliffe wrote an interesting chapter about violence entering the domestic sphere, and how that affected the women and children of Ireland. In this chapter, she argues that traditionally, military historians focus on the horrors of the front lines and armies, while ignoring or mentioning in passing how war can enter the home front. This is particularly true during guerrilla warfare, where the front line cuts through everyday interactions and can't be regulated to a battlefield elsewhere. Linda Connolly supports Mary McAuliffe by writing that for a long time, violence was defined as male against male, and rarely referenced women. For the women of Ireland, war meant they became legitimate targets of reprisals, harassment, physical and sexual assault, and sometimes rape, simply for being in the way, for being related to rebels, whether that led to the woman's active participation in the Civil War or not, and or associating with the wrong people and or cause. At first, the anti-treaty IRA and National Army would fight in garrison cities, meaning many civilians, including women, were often in harm's way just by trying to live normal lives. They would become known as acceptable casualties, and there were several incidences where either the Free State forces or the anti-treaty forces killed women via indiscriminate firing during a shootout. Homes could be commandeered, leaving women in danger of being accused of helping one side or the other and open to reprisals. Oftentimes, the house could be destroyed during the fight, leaving families without a place to live and no help from the government to start over. Once the anti-treaty IRA switched to guerrilla warfare, homes became open to raids, women were harassed at work, in their homes, and on the streets. If the Free State couldn't catch and punish the rebels on the run, they would take it out on the women they left behind. This was a similar tactic the British used during the Irish War of Independence, and won the Free State forces little support. However, as we discussed in our last episode in the Protestants of Ireland, the anti-treaty forces had few fans because of their tactics. Every house they burned, every threatening note they sent, every act of physical or sexual assault affected women. If anti-treaty forces requisitioned food, it meant women couldn't feed their families or themselves. If the livestock were butchered or maimed, then the family would lose their source of income. All these actions would add up, causing internal distress, physical and mental illnesses, and created a life of uncertainty and trauma. Part 2A, sexual assault. One of the most contentious issues of both the Irish War for Independence and the Irish Civil War is sexual assault. Often we think of sexual assault as rape, but in reality, sexual assault is far more complicated and nuanced, involving several examples that may not seem like sexual assault at first glance. Additionally, by limiting sexual assault to rape, accounts of sexual assault will immediately be undercounted because people so rarely report rape to this day. This tendency was 10 times worse in the conservative society of the British Empire of the 1900s. So we're basically deciding that sexual assault will be counted as low because we've defined it within the limits of rape, which in turn is rarely reported. And since it's rarely reported, historians will argue it rarely happened, which will be backed up by evidence and so on, becoming the Ouroboros, a snake continuously eating its own tail. During the Irish Civil War, only a handful of cases of rape were recorded and brought to the attention of the Cosgrave Administration and Ministry of Defense. Even fewer went to trial. None of the trials addressed the actual assault or offered any justice to the victims. This has led to the claim that Ireland was quote-unquote special during its Civil War and rarely recourse to using rape as a weapon against women. So far, the data supports this assertion, but it becomes less clear when we include other examples of assault, such as body searches, head shavings, and raids in private dwellings, and all that may entail. It becomes even muddier when we consider how the very risk of rape and assault could affect a woman's mental and physical health. Linda Connolly herself argues that historians should investigate the hospitalization of women following the Irish Civil War and see how many were treated for mental breakdowns, what we now know as trauma, etc. Great work is already being done on the women who had to give up their children because of out-of-marriage sexual liaisons. How many of these were results of assault during the Irish War of Independence and the Irish Civil War? Sexual assault is often hidden in plain sight. It will take creative and interdisciplinary efforts for us to uncover the full story of assault during the Irish Civil War. For the purpose of this episode, we will discuss the few documented cases of rape, body searches, head shavings. Part 2B. Purpose of assaulting women during the Irish Civil War. Before discussing the specifics, I want to take a moment and discuss the purpose of sexual assault during wartime. Physically, sexual assault is a way to control society. Because of social and religious expectations of the time, women were often seen as the holder of a state's morality. If the women were quote-unquote protected and quote-unquote taken care of while also being punished for breaking quote-unquote moral standards, then the state was quote-unquote healthy and quote-unquote moral. A woman was expected to be pure, mothers, potential girlfriends slash wives, beautiful, kind, and the organizers of the home, and should never expect credit for fulfilling these requirements. Anytime women broke these expectations, they would experience pushback. In the context of the Irish Civil War, women were often assaulted because they exhibited the wrong kind of loyalty. Either a woman was accused of being with a British officer, flirting with a Free State officer, and oftentimes even just talking to an officer, whether they be British or part of the Free State Army. Other women provided more substantial aid. Women were also punished for either having husbands who were anti-treaty IRA members or who were pro-treaty IRA members. As the war progressed, and anti-treaty women grew in prominence and more vitriolic in their support for a republic, the Cosgrave administration, which is already pretty sexist, turned against Irish women as a whole, blaming them for the violence and calling them the quote-unquote wrong ones, hysterical, broken, and unwanted. The quote-unquote good Irish women supported the pro-treaty government by returning to the homes, raising the children, and keeping order. They didn't want to engage in politics, trusting men to know what was best. Not only did this make women vulnerable to humiliating and traumatizing scrutiny, it also opened them up to assault on either side and diminished women's rights and causes to something unnatural. This made it easier for the Cosgrove administration to strip women of their rights starting in 1924 and finished by the De Valera administration with the announcement of a new constitution in 1937. Even if we assume that the act of sexual assault and rape was lower than other countries who have also experienced civil wars, we cannot ignore the impact the threat of assault had on women. Margaret Connery, a suffragist, reported to the Irish White Cross that, quote, women and children were in a constant state of depression and nervous breakdown, and that nighttime was dreaded as women were particularly, quote, knew that it was during curfew hours attempts of a sexual nature had been made. And this quote is from Susan Burns' article, Keeping Company with the Enemy, Gender and Sexual Violence Against Women During the Irish War of Independence and Civil War. Erskine Childers describes the terror women often went through in his propaganda piece, A Typical Night in Dublin. Quote, as the citizens go to bed, the barracks spring to life. Lorries, tanks, and armored searchlight cars, muster in fleets, list of objectives are distributed, and when the midnight curfew order has emptied the streets, pitch-dark streets, the weird cavalcades issue forth to the attack. Think of raiding a private home at dead of night in a tank, my own experience, in a tank whose weird rumble and roar can be heard miles away. The procedure of the raid is in keeping, though the objectives are held for the most part by women and terrified children. A thunder of knots, no time to dress, even for a woman alone, or the door will crash in. On opening, in charge the soldiers, literally charge, with fixed bayonets and in full war kit. This quote is also from Susan Burns' article, Keeping with the Enemy. While we can acknowledge that that is a propaganda piece, one cannot overestimate how much damage the fear of violence can cause, leading to complex trauma, PTSD, anxiety, and depression, amongst other medical conditions. The threat of rape, especially if it was sanctioned by the government, reinforced a woman's precarious position within Irish society, making them feel alone, worthless, and in constant danger. Women not only had to sacrifice their loved ones to a civil war no one wanted, they themselves became another front of war where soldiers from both sides tried to forcefully shape Irish society by violating those they saw as vulnerable and within their control. Part 2C. Personal searches. Another form of assault that is often ignored in the context of war is the violation of being personally searched. Cultural standards of the time would have dictated that women had to be searched by the same sex, but this didn't always happen. Even when it was a woman searching another woman, the experience was traumatizing as it completely stole autonomy and privacy from the woman being searched. Hannah Shay Steffington, an awesome feminist and activist, recorded a personal search she witnessed. Quote, two young girls were arrested, marched on foot to the Barrett Square, where they were kept standing for 2 hours in bitter cold. Number one was then ordered into the barracks to be searched. She was conducted by a soldier into a small bare room with an undraped window looking out at the Barrett Square. The door was then locked, and she was confronted by a cloaked, masked, and gloved figure, by whom she was stripped absolutely naked and searched. On resuming her clothes, she was brought back to the square, and the second girl was taken into the barrack and subject to the same ordeal. This often happened upon arrest, and frequently in women's prisons, an experience we'll discuss in detail in another episode. It was a flagrant violation of a woman's body, and just as it is overlooked today, it was overlooked during the Irish Civil War as just another condition of war. That didn't prevent the women who were searched from being traumatized repeatedly by the very state meant to protect and serve them. Part 2D, head shaving. An incredibly traumatic tactic used against women during the Irish Civil War was head shaving. Women were often forcefully taken from their homes, usually in their nightwear, taken somewhere isolated, sometimes blindfolded and bound, and sometimes held by other men, and their hair was shaved off. This was to humiliate them and to mark them as quote-unquote wrong. It wasn't fashionable for women to wear their hair short at the time, and people noticed when women tried to hide what had been done to them. It was a badge of dishonor and served as a warning to others. It also wasn't uncommon for a woman to be shaved and sexually assaulted, the head shaving tragically ensuring the woman couldn't report the assault because she was doubly dishonored. Women were often shaved because they supported the quote-unquote wrong side. Either they helped the British during the Irish War of Independence, and this was belated punishment, or they sided with the quote-unquote pro-British, anti-Irish provisional government, and thus were quote-unquote traitors to their own people. One IRA officer explained it as, quote, some young girls created a problem. The British uniform was an attraction for them, as indeed would any uniform. They could be a real danger to the movement and gave bad example by consorting with the enemy. They were warned repeatedly and stronger measures had to be resorted to. No volunteer liked the job, but on occasions, these girls' hair had to be cut. Years later, Dame fashion was to dictate bobbed hair, but at this period of revolution, it was deemed shameful. And this quote is from Linda Connolly's book, Women and the Irish Revolution, page 114. The reason historians label this as sexual assault is because of the traditional connection of a woman's hair with their sexuality. Even today, people will comment when women have incredibly short or shaved heads and make certain assumptions about that woman's gender, sexuality, and personal choices based on how short her hair is. I remember when they were making the Hunger Games movie, Natalie Dormer had like half of her head shaved, and this was like the biggest thing in the world. There were so many articles about it, so many interviews about it. People kept asking her, like, why are you doing that? How does it feel to have your head shaved? And it was only half of her head. So, like, people have weird connections between women's hair and their sexuality and their virtue and, like, whatever. Additionally, these shavings often happened in the middle of the night when women were in bed, i.e. vulnerable and in their nightwear, i.e. tempting fate. It was almost solely men who carried out the punishment, adding to the dimension of sexual assault and male control. Part 3. Known cases of rape. As of the date of this episode, cases of rape and or gang rape perpetrated by soldiers in the Irish Civil War have been recorded in North Mayo, North Tipperary, West Meath, and South Armagh. And while it is true that at this point the data supports the assertion that rape wasn't used quote-unquote systematically during the Irish Civil War, it still occurred, it still traumatized the victims, and it revealed a darker, misogynistic side to Irish society that is still sadly present in all societies in the world today. We will discuss three instances of rape that occurred during the Irish Civil War. Part 3A, the rape of Eileen Biggs. The first case I want to discuss is the case of Eileen Biggs, a Protestant Irish woman. Her experience was recorded in a 1926 Irish Grants Commission application and states that Eileen, her husband, and the guest were in her marital home in the Dromoneer area when anti-treaty IRA men took over the house. They locked Eileen in one room and locked her husband and house guest in two different adjoining rooms. The anti-treaty men drank and looted the house before raping Eileen 8 or 9 different times, hurting her in the process. When the IRA men left, Eileen was found semi-conscious and traumatized. She would never recover from her experience. She spent time in a Dublin hospital before going to England with her husband. She was rewarded a £6,000 compensation. Eileen and her husband moved to Longford Place, Monkstown in Dublin. She died on June 8, 1950, at St. Patrick's Hospital, Dublin, a psychiatric hospital. The men who raped her were never identified or brought to justice. Part 3B, the gang rape of Margaret Dougherty. The second case I want to discuss is the rape of Margaret Dougherty, which was only investigated by historians recently after a military service pension application submitted by Margaret's mother was published online in May 2018. Margaret was living in Foxford during the Civil War. She was the only living daughter of the Dougherty family. One of her brothers died in Flanders, and two of her brothers fought on the anti-treaty IRA side. Margaret was active with Cumann na Bon until her mother grew ill and she needed to stay home and care for her. On May 27, 1923, a group of Free State soldiers dragged Margaret from her bed, stripped her naked, and raped her. She suffered a traumatic mental breakdown, and her mother claims she was totally incapacitated until her death on December 28, 1928, 5 years after she was gang raped. Three doctors who treated Margaret after the incident concur with her mother's statement. General of Defense Richard Mulcahy knew of the case, and based on his own papers as well as official documents, it was a matter of great contention within the Cosgrave administration. One of the documents named Lieutenants Waters, Benson, and Mulholland as the perpetrators. Mulcahy directed a court-martial to be held, but it was clear he didn't believe there was enough evidence to get a conviction. The court-martial was held on July 25, 1923. The three lieutenants were found not guilty and honorably acquitted. It is doubtful the Minister of Defense made any real effort to get justice for Margaret, and the court-martial was to placate the outrage within the government and the public generated by the case. Part 3C, the Kenmare case. The final case I will discuss is maybe the most famous case of the Irish Civil War, the Kenmare case. On June 2nd, 1923, three free state officers, Captain Flood, Captain Clark, and Major General O'Daly, who is a piece of shit, and we'll get into his thing later in the season, raped the sisters Florence and Jessie McCarthy. The sisters' father, Dr. Randall McCarthy, described the incident as, quote, Florence was confronted by three masked and armed men, one of whom seized her and covered her with a revolver and flashed an electric torch in her face. When she screamed, her little sister ran from her own bedroom to the rescue. One of the three rushed the doors and dragged Jessie down the stairs by her hair and out of doors. Here, she was beaten with a Sam Brown belt, kicked, and trotted on by two of the brutes. And this quote is from Linda Connolly's article, Sexual Violence in the Irish Civil War, A Forgotten War Crime. The rapists made a mistake when they targeted Dr. Randall's daughters. He pushed the government to investigate the incident. A court of inquiry was held on June 28th, where O'Daly was allowed to attack the integrity of the family, especially of the victims. All of Randall's witnesses were arrested under the orders of Daly and received threats of violence. The judge, Advocate General Cahar David, wrote that he believed the facts revealed during the inquiry supported a, quote, a prima facie case against the three officers of having committed serious criminal offenses and having been guilty of very scandalous conduct unbecoming the character of officers. He advised that, quote, all three be ordered for trial by a court-martial on charges to be framed in accordance with the facts as disclosed in the evidence given before the court of inquiry. And again, quote is from Linda Connolly's article, Sexual Violence in the Irish Civil War, A Forgotten War Crime. Mulcahy, unfortunately and disgustingly, disagreed. He trusted O'Daly and took the general's word when O'Daly claimed he wasn't involved at all. Mulcahy claimed that O'Daly was a, quote, disciplined, temperate, energetic, intelligent to appreciate civil as well as military requirements, a good disciplinarian, and a leader of men. He spoke to O'Daly and, quote, asked him straight, as man to man, if he had been involved in the assault on the McCarthys. Quote, on his word of honor, O'Daly had assured him he was not. Quote is from Linda Connolly's article, Sexual Violence in the Irish Civil War, A Forgotten War Crime. David vehemently disagreed with Mulcahy and suggested that he should consult Attorney General Hugh Kennedy as, quote, the question of whether any such prosecution should be taken in the ordinary civil courts would have to be decided by Kennedy as law advisor or by the government on his advice. Quote again is from Linda Connolly's article, Sexual Violence in the Irish Civil War, A Forgotten War Crime. Kennedy agreed with Mulcahy. This pissed Kevin O'Higgins off, and he threatened to leave the government if it wasn't properly handled. Other members of the cabinet, like Ernest Blythe, the Minister of Finance, felt that O'Higgins was over-exaggerating and that he did not agree with, quote, O'Higgins in feeling particularly revolted at what seemed to be merely a case of a couple of tarts getting a few lashes that did them no harm. Quote is from Linda Connolly's article, Sexual Violence in the Irish Civil War. Even those who supported O'Higgins felt that they couldn't risk the Army's reputation during a civil war over something that they considered a quote-unquote ordinary war incident. The Army's reputation, and the reputation of a general who had also been in Collins' squad, was more important than justice for the violated women. McCarthy was unsuccessful in pressing his daughter's case further, but he wrote to O'Higgins in 1927, after O'Higgins became Minister for Justice, quote, when I see your title, I wonder what justice you meted out to me and mine, and later wrote, quote, yes, I waited for over 3 years hoping that I might get some justice from the free state government when it restabilized, but my hopes were in vain. End quote is from Linda Connolly's article, Sexual Violence in the Irish Civil War, A Forgotten War Crime. Thank you for listening. I know this episode was a difficult one, and I hope you found it insightful. You can listen to my full catalog on Spotify, iTunes, my website, www.samswarroom.com. Please join my Patreon at www.patreon.com/AOAwarfare to keep up to date on all my projects. Until next time, wear a mask, organize with your community, demand a ceasefire in Gaza, and stay safe.